Fire away.
Welcome to the Agricultural Economics Podcast. This is Jessica Eyes here with my co-host, Dr. Ken Foster, the head of the department here. How are you doing, Ken?
I'm doing great, Jessica. How are you?
It's a beautiful summer day.
It is a beautiful summer day. Hey, I have a question for you. I know you hate it when I ask you these questions and you might not know the answer, but do you know who Justin Morrill was?
You know, I know of the name Morrill because I'm aware that it is an award that is bequeathed upon people in our department.
There is a huge Purdue campus award called the Morrill Award, but it's named after a historical figure, Justin Morrill, who was a member of the House of Representatives during the Civil War. And this guy, even while this war was raging, tearing the country apart, had the foresight to say, you know what, folks, we really need to invest in the future of our country in some very fundamental way. And so he proposed an act that I think the formal name of it was the Land Grant College Act, but it's become known as the Morrill Act. But it established the funding for higher education that I'm going to paraphrase here because I don't really want to quote from Mr. Morrill. But so this bill proposes to establish at least one college in every state upon a sure and perpetual foundation accessible to all, but especially to the sons of toil, where all of needful science for practical avocations of life shall be taught. And he goes on to say, the higher graces of classical studies should not be entirely ignored. And he says, and where agriculture, the foundation of all present and future prosperity, may look for troops of earnest friends studying its familiar and recondite economies and at last elevating it to the higher level where it may fearlessly invoke comparison with the most advanced studies of the world. So what a phenomenal thing. And today in every state in the U.S. we have a land-grant college where we study all kinds of things and we communicate that to each other. You know this, right? We actually now not only communicate about science, but we study the science of communicating about science.
To the point where Alan Alda is actually
started a center for communicating
the
about
sciences.
Science,
yeah. Yeah.
And science communication. And today we have with us the most recent recipient of Purdue's Morrill Award, honoring this high standard, this high goal of creating science-based knowledge and educating society about important topics that are meaningful to them and raise the level of the economy for everybody. So I'm going to let you introduce our guest. He is the most recent recipient of the Morrill Award at Purdue.
I wonder how many of our listeners can guess who it is based on that information.
Well, they give away several of these every year. So.
All right. Well, we are very, very pleased to have Dr. Wally Tyner here with us in our studio today. Dr. Wally Tyner is a former head of the department here in the Agricultural Economics Department, and he's done a lot of work over the years on some really interesting and very important issues. And welcome, Wally. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you. A little anecdote about Wally. The other day, I was walking over to record him in the studio, and he must have been stopped at least three times by three different people saying, "Wally Tyner," recognizing him from the television. And I'm like, "Oh, I am in the presence of greatness," and I did not even know it.
That's right. Yeah. No. And Wally Tyner was the department head who hired me at Purdue. So.
So clearly, he has great
Made
foresight.
At least one good decision.
Let's hope so.
And Ken Foster is the department head who hired me. So we
completed the circle.
Anyway, so thanks for joining us, Ken. You want to introduce the topic?
Yeah,
a little
sure.
Bit?
Wally is well known worldwide for his work in the economics of energy and energy markets, and so one of the things that's going on today is some decisions being made in Washington with respect to the renewable fuel standard. So I thought we should bring Wally in and have him tell us a little bit about what's going on, maybe give us a little historical perspective on the renewable fuel standard to start with, but then give us a an update. What's happening today and what are the potential implications for that? So, Wally, maybe give us a little history on renewable fuel standard.
Sure. The renewable fuel standard came out of the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. So it's been around for a while, and it established a slowly increasing mandate for biofuels in several different categories. There was corn ethanol, there was biodiesel, there was advanced biofuels, and then another category called other advanced, which included sugarcane ethanol, mainly from Brazil. And it's been growing each year, and it's grown to the point that now we have reached something that's called the blend wall for corn ethanol. And the blend wall is basically the point at which you can't blend more, you can't market more ethanol at 10% of the gasoline. And we consume 135 billion gallons of gasoline in the U.S. each year, so 10% of that is 13.5 billion. But the actual legislated mandate is 15 billion. So that's what all the controversy is about, is the ethanol industry says, hey, that's what Congress intended was 15. EPA and the oil industry and a lot of others are saying, yeah, but we got this blend wall thing. We can't force people to market something they can't really do because of this infrastructure issue. So anything that happens today with the renewable fuel standard is controversial. And EPA found themselves in a position of being behind in getting out the requirements. So they issued recently the requirements, or their proposed requirements, for 2014, 2015, and 2016. They're playing catch-up. And so obviously what they did for 2014, since they released this last week, is they just ratified what happened. That's all they could do. They couldn't require that people do something when the time's already passed, so they just ratified what actually happened in terms of production and blending and the like. But they ramped things up for 15, 16, and 17 a little bit, 17 only for biodiesel. For 15, they set the corn ethanol mandate right at the blend wall, 13.5 billion. So the ethanol industry thought, that could do further, we could have more E85, we could have more E15. The oil industry says this is a real problem for us, it's a compliance cost or high. But one view is that EPA reached a compromise among all these conflicting parties. They have it growing in 2016, corn ethanol, to 14 billion gallons, so it goes beyond the blend wall, but not way beyond the blend wall. So it causes the industry to stretch a little bit, but not to stretch beyond what they could accomplish. It has biodiesel growing a lot. It has biodiesel growing 1.6, 1.7, 1.8 billion gallons, when the original legislated level was 1 billion. And then there's this other advanced category that can also include biodiesel, up to 400 million gallons in 2016. So that means that biodiesel could be over 2 billion gallons, double what the original mandate was.
So are there substitutes across these, right? If we do more biodiesel, can we substitute to meet the mandate, or are these mandates pretty specific in terms of different fuel types?
That's a great question, Ken. The RFS is what's called, it's a mandate, but it's a nested structure. So the only thing that can go, and I call the different nest buckets, the only thing that can go in the biodiesel bucket is biodiesel. But then if you have more biodiesel than you need for that bucket, it can spill over into the other advanced category. And if you have more than you need for that, it can even spill over into the corn category. The only thing that can go into the cellulosic biofuel category is cellulosic biofuels. But if you have more than you need, it can spill over into the other advanced, and it can spill over into the corn. So it's a complicated structure, in reality, even though all those things are possible, the only thing that really spills over is biodiesel into the other categories. The others pretty much stay in the bucket that they're assigned to.
So you mentioned that the 15 mandate that EPA has set out stretches us a little bit in terms of corn ethanol, takes us beyond the blend wall. How do we get that extra ethanol consumed in the market? Does it mean E85, it's going to be cheaper?
Yeah, it's the 2016 implicit. There is actually legally no corn ethanol mandate, but it's an implicit mandate, and it's 14 billion gallons in 2016. And there's several ways that it can be met. One is that there's close to 2 billion carry forward RINs. And that means that the industry already has some RINs stored up. They can just use those. So it wouldn't require any change in behavior. If they didn't want to use some of those carry forward RINs, then it's E85 or E15 that will help get beyond the blend wall. Bruce Babcock and I have both argued that if we let the market work, the price of RINs would rise high enough that E15 would become profitable to blend, and you could have a lot more E15. We have about 12 million cars on the road that can consume it. We have 2,100 stations that can sell it. And right now, almost nothing's happening in that market. But if the price of RINs were high enough, so that you got a high enough subsidy, in a sense, for selling E85, it would happen.
Oh, well, I actually have a bit of a political question here, and I'm going to bring this back a little bit more into layman's terms, possibly for those who are listening who may not understand. So just one question for you. The Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, they're supposed to have this out every year, right? The renewable fuel standards every year.
Correct.
Okay. And isn't that what they're legally obligated to do?
Yes, that's exactly right. Last year, they proposed a standard for 2014. They didn't actually propose it until late spring. They got thousands and hundreds of thousands of comments. They're also legally obliged to read all these comments.
Okay.
And to consider them. The result, and then in November, they actually sent something to the White House. But something else happens in November in this country, elections, and the White House didn't want to release it at that point. So it didn't get released at all. It just, nothing happened. And so EPA was so far behind at that point that they decided, okay, we're just going to play catch up now. We're going to decide what we're going to do for 14, which ratifies all they could do, and then 15 and 16, and they released it a week ago. It will go final in November, so they will then be caught up. They're supposed to release it in November of every year, so they'll be caught up for 16 by releasing this three-year mandate in November of 15.
Do these delays have a detrimental impact on the economy?
Sure. They increase compliance costs, they increase uncertainty. Put yourself in a position, you're a biofuel producer, you've got a plant, how much do you produce? You don't know what people are going to be obliged to buy. And the same for all the players. The RIN markets, the RINs are the way the mandate's enforced. It's called a renewable fuel identification number. There's a market you can buy and sell them. And that market, for example, the market for biodiesel RINs, since this announcement, has gone up, and corn ethanol RINs has gone down, just exactly what you would expect to happen given what EPA did. But before that, the RINs sort of went any direction because people didn't know what was going to happen. There was this huge uncertainty. So this step is an important step to regain some stability for this system. The system can work, but it has to be announced ahead of time in order to work, in order to work well.
Does that concern you? Did that this kind of delay that happens and is even?
The irony here is that when EPA released their original standard in proposed standard in 2014, they acknowledged the blend wall, and the furor came up. But the oil industry was unhappy because they retained a standard. The ethanol industry was unhappy because for the first time they lowered the corn ethanol mandate. They did it, I think, because they were afraid that Congress would just eliminate the renewable fuel standard if they didn't do something.
Right.
But the upshot is that everybody was unhappy. They got all these comments. They had to consider all these comments. It became completely political. So now they found themselves in a position of, okay, let's try to correct this, let's play catch up. And so by doing it for all 3 years, hopefully they will have accomplished that and will come back to a situation where the market can function as it's intended to.
For those of us who may not have that much of a background in this, for anyone who might be listening, can you give a little bit more of an explanation of what the blend wall is, what that means?
Sure. It's almost a historical accident. We chose in the late 70s to have a product called Gasohol that was 10% ethanol and 90% gasoline. So for better or for worse, we chose that.
Gasohol?
Blend. Right, it's called Gasohol.
Clever.
At that point, gasoline consumption was growing fast. And no one ever dreamed that we wouldn't be at this point to 150 billion gallons. So the blend wall was not, it wasn't even in anybody's minds at that point. All the cars were manufactured to take 10% ethanol because it's a little more corrosive, it has problems with water, so they solved all those problems. All the cars were built to that standard. So we got locked into that. Then we had a recession. We had a new fuel economy standard. Our gasoline consumption peaked at 143 billion gallons. We're now at 135 billion, so it's been falling because of fuel economy standards. You know, the corporate average fuel economy is now increasing every year. And with higher prices, people at least have been buying more fuel-efficient cars. So now we're at 135 billion gallons. The RFS was slated to be at 15 billion gallons, but if you put it at 15 billion gallons, 10% of 15, 150 is 15 billion gallons. 10% of 135 billion is 13.5 billion. That's less than the original mandate. So it can't be done unless you get a lot more of another blend of ethanol that's authorized in this country called E85. That blend is 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline or thereabouts. But that requires a car that's specially built. It's called a flex fuel car to handle that E85 blend. And we have about 240 million cars in the country, and about 12 million of them are flex fuel. So it's a fairly small share of the total. We have 161,000 gasoline stations in the country, and 2,100 of those can sell E85. So the infrastructure's not there to go gangbusters on E85, but it is there to sell some. But right now, E85 is too expensive to be economical. So the only way we'll sell more E85 is if the price of E85 falls.
And the relative to gasoline.
Relative to gasoline. Because E85 contains about 70% of the energy of gasoline, so it gets about 70% of the mileage of gasoline.
Okay.
So you won't buy it if you're a rational consumer.
but are consumers rational, though? That's the question.
That is a question.
Sure, yes. There are some corn farmers out there driving flex fuel vehicles that always buy E85.
That's right.
That's their own sort of rationality.
That's right.
Supporting their industry.
That's right.
Important to them.
That's right. Absolutely. But many consumers won't buy it unless it's at least gives them the same mileage per dollar that gasoline does. And the only way that E85 will get low enough is if the mandate became really binding, the renewable fuel standard became really binding, and the price of the enforcement mechanism, which is called a RIN, rose high enough that you blend all this ethanol, you get all these RINs, and so you can sell the E85 a lot cheaper. EPA thinks that's not likely to happen, but they did increase the RFS enough to give it a chance to happen.
All right.
So
So, Wally, one of the things that we keep hearing about that's a little bit of a controversy around the renewable fuel standard is the potential effect on food prices. And I know you've done some work on this, and while we've got you here in the studio, I think it's important for us maybe to just touch on that. So any thoughts with respect to food prices and renewable fuels?
It's a complicated subject. And
you mean more complicated than what we just went over right now?
You bet.
Probably all right. Podcast.
We might have to give us a summary.
Well, there have been a lot of studies done on it. Phil Abbott and Chris Hurd and I have done 3 different studies on it. And we conclude that it's a contributing factor. But it is not the major driver of changes in food prices. There's the exchange rate, the dollar exchange rate. There's supply shocks all over the world. There are stocks get really low if consumption is higher than production for several years in a row. The stocks we have get low, and that means that any kind of little supply disruption causes a big run-up in food prices. That's what we saw in 2009, 2008, and then we saw in 2011 another smaller version of that. So our sense is that it's a whole lot of factors, of which corn ethanol is one, but not the major one. Let me mention one other thing that we've done recently, and I'm presenting a paper on this in Italy next week. We asked the question, what would happen if GMOs went away in the United States? And we ask it from several perspectives. What happens to land use? What happens to prices? The interesting thing is that prices, food prices, go up more if GMOs went away, a lot more than they did or have due to biofuels. But more interestingly to me, or just as interesting, is that land use change if they went away. If you don't have GMOs and you don't have the higher yields that they bring about, you need more land to produce the crops. So that means you have to take forest, you have to take pasture away, not only here but around the world. And we found that if you took GMOs away just in the United States, the land use emissions would be greater than the whole U.S. biofuels program.
Oh, that is so interesting.
It is. Yeah.
And this is why we love science.
That's exactly right.
And communicating science.
Didn't we do a podcast a couple weeks ago about evidence-based policy?
Yes. Yeah, oh, this is fascinating. I think our next podcast should just be on the value of communicating science.
I think so, yeah.
Wally, I just want to thank you so much for joining Ken and I today. And
my pleasure.
Yeah,
it's fun.
Yeah, and for all of you listeners, again, this is the Agricultural Economics Podcast from Purdue University's Department of Agricultural Economics. And please check us out on Facebook or follow us on Twitter.
Yeah, and visit our website at www.agecon.purdue.edu.